Returning to my room, I again passed through the oven room. The men seemed to be working even more slowly than before. I informed my two colleagues of the plan, but refrained from mentioning it to the lab assistant. He would inevitably be drawn into it once it began, but I saw no need to inform him of it for the present. Time moved forward on leaden feet. Lunchtime arrived. We ate slowly, then went into the crematorium courtyard to warm ourselves in the slanting rays of the autumn sun. I noticed that the SS guards were nowhere to be seen, but there was probably nothing unusual about that. It had happened more than once before. They were no doubt in their rooms. The gates were closed. Outside, the camp SS on duty were at their posts, so I accorded no importance to the absence of guards inside. I smoked my cigarette in peace. To know that within a few hours, we would be outside these barbed wires and free again, lifted a dark cloud from my mind. A cloud that had hovered there since my first day in the Katzet. Even if the attempt failed, I would have lost nothing. I looked at my watch. 1:30. I got up and asked my colleagues to join me for the autopsy, so we could be ready with a report when Dr. Mengele arrived to pick it up. They followed me silently into the dissecting room, and we began the autopsy immediately. Today, one of my associates was performing the dissection while I recorded his findings on my typewriter. We had been working for about 20 minutes when a tremendous explosion rocked the walls. In the echoing silence, the ready staccato of machine gun fire reached our ears, piercing through the green mosquito netting that covered the main window. I saw the red-tiled roof and supporting beams of No. 3 crematorium blow off, followed by an immense spiral of flame and black smoke. No more than a minute later, machine gun fire broke out just in front of the dissection room door. We had no idea what had happened. Our plans called for tonight. Two possibilities occurred to me. Either someone had betrayed us, thus enabling the SS to step in and break up the planned escape, or else a considerable force of partisans had attacked the camp. The dismal wail of sirens began in both Auschwitz I and Auschwitz II. The explosions grew louder and louder, and the rattle of submachine guns more and more persistent. Then we could hear the harsher staccato of field machine guns. I'd already made up my mind what to do. Whether it was a question of treason or of partisan attack, it seemed best for the moment to remain in the dissecting room and see how the situation evolved. From the window, I saw 80 to 100 trucks arriving. The first one pulled up in front of our crematorium. Half a company jumped out and formed up in battle formation in front of the barbed wire fences. I began to see what had happened. The Sonderkommando men had taken possession of No. 1 crematorium, and from every window and door were spraying the SS troops with bullets and grenades. Their defense seemed effective, for I saw several soldiers drop, either dead or wounded. Seeing this, the besiegers decided to resort to more drastic methods. They brought up 50 well-trained police dogs and unleashed them on the Sonderkommando entrenched behind the walls of No. 1. But for some strange reason, these dogs, usually so ferocious and obedient, refused to budge. Ears back, tails between their legs, they took shelter behind their SS masters. Perhaps it was because the dogs had been trained to deal with prisoners wearing striped burlap, whereas the Sonderkommando men never wore this uniform. Or perhaps too long used to dealing with weakened, unarmed prisoners, they were momentarily frightened by the smell of powder and scorched flesh, the noise and confusion of a pitched battle. In any case, the SS soon realized their mistake and without letting up on their fire, began to haul some howitzers into position.